welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Wednesday, February 8, 2023. Sudanese groups continue to negotiate issues crucial for the formation of a civilian-led government.
The process is still unfolding, and it's unclear where this is going to ultimately end up.
And some patients at Bor Civil Hospital are stuck due to a strike by the staff.
I came with my child to the hospital a while ago and I've not found a doctor around. The doctors are not in the hospital. I'm now confused on what to do. My child is very sick.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Negotiations are still continuing in Sudan on sticky issues like involvement of non-signatory parties and armed groups on board. The United Nations says the process should be inclusive. VOA's Nabil Biagio spoke to Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, about the process and its impact.
The process is still unfolding, and it's unclear where this is going to ultimately end up. It is a big breakthrough that there is a agreement reached that Sudan should have a civilian government. However, the military has made similar promises in the past that it hasn't followed through. There's a lot of details that still need to be sorted out about just how that transition would take place. And what specific authorities the civilians would have versus the military, how the military would be integrated, how issues of past human rights abuses will be dealt with. So there's a lot that still needs to be sorted out. But I think the positive aspect of it is that the dialogue is continuing on all sides.
It was clear from the start that the framework agreement was not popular with the streets. Protests continued. A faction of the Forces for Freedom and Change remains a non-signatory along with other parties. Will this process be able to garner consensus at the end of the day?
Building consensus will be an ongoing process. The civilian negotiators have been involved in holding various workshops and trying to educate and enhance understanding of what the agreement is about and how a transition can move forward. So I think it's an evolving process. Now, there are valid reasons for distrust from the street towards the agreement. The military has reneged on previous commitment to transition. The military has been responsible for several hundred killings of protesters since 2019. And many ordinary citizens just don't trust the military and want to hold it accountable. The military has, over the decades of its control, but including the period since 2019, been reported to have been engaged in corruption. And so there's a strong demand on the part of civilians that the military not have any role moving forward. And that's where some of that resistance we're seeing is coming from.
The United Nations, as part of the mediation team, which is consisting of the UN, the African Union, and IGAD, the trilateral mechanism, issued a statement recently saying that it's critical that the negotiations that are taking place right now be inclusive. How can that be achieved, that inclusivity?
Well, I think there's multiple layers of the inclusiveness that's required. On the civilian side, there are multiple factions that need to be brought in, and that process is happening through dialogue and exchanges. Inevitably, there are going to be differences of opinion, and the question is just going to be whether there is sufficient consensus, maybe not absolute consensus, that there's a need to move forward. Likewise, There are a couple of armed groups who had previously made deals with the junta that gave them some sort of power sharing arrangement. They also haven't signed on to the framework agreement because they feel that their position will be weakened under a civilian-led government. And so there is going to be a need to facilitate dialogue and bring them in as well. Fortunately, you know, those conversations are happening, and it will be just a matter of seeing how much progress can be brought along. I think, you know, the bottom line is there's going to have to be some compromise to reach consensus on all sides, and getting the various elements to realize that, and to realize that a compromise solution is going to be better than the current status quo, will be the real test of the negotiator's skills.
That's Joseph Segley, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke to my colleague, Nabil Biagio. Still on Sudan, Sudanese officials and charity organizations are developing a plan to protect schools and other learning institutions in conflict zones. An official with Save the Children says the group has documented dozens of schools in West Darfur State which have been occupied by armed forces. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
At a Save the Schools Declaration workshop at Salam Rotana Hotel in Khartoum earlier this week, Save the Children and Sudanese education officials created an action plan to ensure that the schools remain places for learning free from violence or conflict. The plan was endorsed by the Federal Ministries of Education and Defense with the aim of supporting efforts to ensure that children and teachers can return to school without fear of soldiers who may have used their building for military purposes. Isla Ahmad Yassin, Director of Planning and Research Policies at the National Ministry of Education, says adhering to plan will be mandatory for all armed forces.
All those who signed the declaration are responsible to abide by its provisions, including all the organized forces, civil societies, and international organizations. All of us shall work together to safeguard the education for our children and ensure that they learn in a safe environment.
Ahmed says the Save Schools declarations calls for ending all forms of occupation of schools and learning facilities by any armed actors or groups for any reason.
The stability of our students, safety of our pupils and schools is very important. This is essential for the educational process, and this we develop our community.
Speaking at the workshop, the head of Save the Children in Sudan, Arshadan Malik, said armed conflict represents an urgent challenge for educational, humanitarian, and developmental priorities in the country. Malik says his office has documented dozens of schools that continue to be occupied by armed forces following intercommunal fighting in West Darfur. Malik says all children in Sudan have the right to learn in a safe environment.
We are really grateful to all the actors for supporting us on this, more specifically the support we received from all these actors on ensuring that schools occupied in West Darfur were vacated and are available for education.
Malik says Save the Children and its partners support all efforts by Sudanese officials to ensure that soldiers vacate schools in conflict zones.
Globally, the Kingdom of Norway has mobilized countries to sign off on a commitment from all the countries to commit for safe learning spaces for children and denounce the occupation of schools for any other purposes apart from education.
In May last year, education official in West Darfur State said at least 23 school children and 6 teachers were killed and 23 students were injured during an intercommunal conflict in the Krenik locality. The head of education department at Krenik locality, Abdulrahim Adam, welcomes the declaration. Speaking from Krenik town on Tuesday, Adam tells South Sudan in Focus that of the 9 schools in the area, at least one is still occupied by armed forces, while others are occupied by internally displaced persons.
We have 3 schools that are now occupied by the IDPs.
We have some schools that are located outside the town, and people are afraid of going there due to insecurity.
Officials at the workshop recommended raising community awareness through media outlets about the dangers of soldiers using educational facilities in conflict zones. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Some patients are stuck at Bor State Hospital due to a strike by health workers over unpaid incentives and what they say are poor working conditions. Dengai Deng has the story for VOA from Juba.
Bor resident Amer Mabio says she brought her 1.5-year-old son, who has a high fever, to the hospital this morning to see a doctor, but was surprised to find the outpatient department was locked. Mabir says she waited hours for a doctor to show up.
I came with my child to the hospital a while ago and I've not found a doctor around. The doctors are not in the hospital. I'm now confused on what to do. My child is very sick. We the residents trust the main hospital to help us treat our children, but now there is no help. We're stranded.
Another Bor resident, Daniel Nyak, says he worries that with the main health facility closed due to the strike, residents won't have access to health care. Nyak says private health structures are too expensive for most citizens, many of whom are underpaid government employees.
That population which is not able to afford the private clinics will not be able to go to anywhere except to stay at home. And when you have a severe condition, whichever disease you have, and you are not able to access where the health services are cheaper. So that means when somebody is having a severe condition, a severe condition will lead to death.
Nyak says it is up to the government to address the issue. Nurse John Anyer, the deputy head of the union at Bor State Hospital, says workers walk off the job because they have not been paid their incentives or salaries for January. Anyath says the over 200 health workers, including doctors, nurses, lab technicians, and cleaners, went on a strike Tuesday.
Find that someone may come in the morning and work until evening. So there's no other way of getting out and look for other means of survival. When we talk of education, most of the children of the staff have been sent out from the school because they are not paid the school fees. So the staff look into it and say that they better lay down their tools. And if the government is not engaging the partner.
And yet, it says workers felt they had no other option but to go on a strike as government officials have ignored their pleas for help. He says families of the staff have nothing to eat and their children have been chased out of school because parents cannot pay school fees.
The ministry has to engage care such that the staff incentive are paid, say that they go and handle their personal problems at their home level.
Jonglei State Health Minister Tong Kwal Manyang says she is aware of the strike and the delay in paying hospital workers incentives.
We had, of course, communicated with CARE and the hospital administration that it was important to pay these incentives because we know most people here, the salaries that they get cannot sustain them. And, of course, incentives are what they look forward to every month. And if they come on time, they are able to solve some of the small issues.
Manyang says workers will likely be paid late this month or in March. She is urging hospital staff to return to work, saying her ministry is engaging with CARE International, which supports the hospital.
After they laid down their tool, there was some communication between the ministry and our partner, which is CARE International, which of course supports the Bor State Hospital. So what came out yesterday, actually it was this morning, is that there's a commitment letter confirming that by next week, at least by end of next week, they will have paid all the incentives for January for the staff of the hospital.
Incentives range from $40 to $600 for a staff. A doctor receives $600. A clinical officer gets $450, while nurses and midwives receive $350. In the recent past, doctors, nurses, clinical officers, midwives, and other staff went on a strike at several health facilities, including Juba Teaching Hospital, South Sudan's only national referral hospital, over the same issues. Many patients were left in the lurch. Compared to other medical professionals in the region, South Sudanese healthcare workers are vastly underpaid and receive no health benefits, according to the South Sudan Doctors Union. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, President Joe Biden's State of the Union address did not touch on Africa. Find out why after the break.
A message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease Control. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Speaking in front of a divided Congress for the first time since he took office, President Joe Biden delivered his second State of Union address Tuesday evening, touting low unemployment numbers and the end of pandemic emergency as he pleads for bipartisanship. That's even more elusive under the Republican-controlled House of Representatives. VOA's White House Bureau, Patsy Widekwasara, has the story.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
During his second State of the Union speech on Tuesday, his third address to a joint session of Congress since taking office, President Joe Biden stayed with his unity agenda.
Speaker, I don't want to ruin your reputation, but I look forward to working with you.
Biden touted increased American manufacturing and legislation that invests in renewable energy production, domestic semiconductor industry, and infrastructure to compete against China.
We used to be number one in the world in infrastructure. We've sunk to 13th in the world. The United States of America, 13th in the world in infrastructure, modern infrastructure. But now we're coming back because we came together and passed the bipartisan infrastructure law.
Addressing high inflation, Biden argued the problem is global, caused by the pandemic and the war on Ukraine, and focus instead on low unemployment.
We've created, with the help of many people in this room, 12 million new jobs, more jobs created in 2 years than any president's created in 4 years.
He highlighted steps his administration took to erase federal student loan debt, increase the number of insured Americans, implement COVID relief programs, and lower prescription drug prices. But can he convince Americans things are looking up? Republicans are determined to stop him, with Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Arkansas governor and former White House press secretary under President Donald Trump, delivering the GOP response.
In the radical left's America, Washington taxes you and lights your hard-earned money on fire. But you get crushed with high gas prices, empty grocery shelves, and our children are taught to hate one another on account of their race, but not to love one another or our great country.
With Republicans controlling the House of Representatives following the November election, new House Speaker Kevin McCarthy has promised renewed scrutiny on the administration, including on the classified documents found in Biden's home, the billions of dollars of aid to Ukraine, and what they say is his weak response to a Chinese surveillance balloon, which the U.S. recently shot down. Despite low unemployment and gas prices down sharply from a record high in mid-2022, Biden's approval ratings remain at 40%. While his speech is unlikely to change that, it does signal that he is likely to run again in 2024. Jennifer Marcicha teaches presidential rhetoric at Texas A&M University.
He didn't say if he is or he isn't, but he made the case for why he should. Right, which is that he can see what needs to be done. He's had all of these successes so far. He's had all of this achievement, but there's still a lot more that he wants to get done.
As a gesture of solidarity to Ukraine, First Lady Jill Biden again invited the country's Ambassador Oksana Markarova. And parents of Tyree Nichols, the black man who was beaten by Tennessee police officers and died days later.
When police officers or police departments violate the public trust, they must be held accountable.
Following recent shootings in California, Biden again called on Congress to ban assault-style rifles. He urged Republicans to come up with immigration reform, debt reduction proposals, and vowed to protect the reproductive rights.
Make no mistake about it. If Congress passes a national ban, I will veto it.
But bipartisan legislation is unlikely under a divided government. In a few months, Biden is set to clash with Republicans who are demanding spending cuts before agreeing to pass a debt ceiling hike to prevent the country from defaulting. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
From reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act.
Still on U.S. politics, after December 2022, Washington hosted U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit, which revived U.S. involvement in Africa, President Joe Biden was expected by some to use his State of Union address to support the growth and protection of democracy in Africa and urge African nations to join the U.S. in suppressing insurgents and Islamic extremists. William Lawrence, professor of international relations at the American University in Washington, explains to VOA's senior analyst Muhammad Al-Ashanawi why the president did not touch on that aspect in his speech.
This is because the way this administration has approached foreign policy from the beginning. But let me first say that part two of the Democracy Summit is happening within the next 2 months. And it is a high foreign policy priority for the administration, even though it wasn't in the speech. But there was a reconfiguration of U.S. foreign policy to make a foreign policy that made sense to the American working class and middle class and prioritized their issues. This administration has clearly decided not to talk about foreign policy that much to U.S. domestic audiences. The only two foreign policy he spent any time on were Ukraine and China, and that was sort of a signaling to the world of what the U.S. cares about in foreign policy with a focus on democracy, you know, as a general theme. And he had this statement, which I didn't quite agree with during the speech, that democracies were up and autocracies down when the NGOs are telling us there is some democratic backsliding going on. So that wasn't directly correct. But he didn't want to get into things like terrorism and insurgencies and extremism, because that's just not a priority anymore for Americans. Including this type of thing in a foreign policy speech will happen, but the speech was only about 5% foreign policy because that's what Americans care about. This is Joe Biden, working class guy from Scranton, Pennsylvania, representative of working class Americans, letting them know that their domestic material well-being matters. And that's why at the opening of the speech, he did talk about the global food crisis, inflation, and the price of energy, because that's what the average American talks about. He wasn't talking to the world. He was talking to Americans he wants to vote for him in 2 years.
President Biden reiterated his campaign pledge and said, "Our nation is working for more freedom, more dignity, and more peace, not just in Europe, but everywhere." Would that mean a doctrine for what is left of his presidency in all parts of the world, especially with a spate of military coups in Africa?
That remains to be seen. This administration has made clear statements of principle and has followed through on those principles in some and not in many others. This raises the question of Palestine. This raises the question of Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the Uyghurs vis-a-vis China. It applies to Western Sahara. It applies to forgotten wars like the Congo and frozen conflicts like Libya or Somalia in its own way and elsewhere. And the coups you mentioned, you know, populations across the world who live in relatively democratic free societies is about 100. That leaves about 90 countries that don't. And The statement of principles implies a principled foreign policy. So the question is, what will we do about the conflict zones and those 90 countries that are unfree? Hopefully the U.S. will do more. I'm not holding my breath. But one thing the U.S. can do is lead on the systems, like human rights reporting, which the U.S. has led the world in, reporting on trafficking, reporting on corruption and terrorist financing. So even when the U.S. isn't necessarily intervening to help this country or population or that country or population, it can sort of lead the world in setting standards. But to directly answer your question, the U.S. will pay lip service on some issues, make small efforts on others, medium efforts on others, and big efforts on others. And let me just say that the U.S. generally is the world's security leader, damned if they do and damned if they don't. When the U.S. intervenes, they're being post-imperialistic and meddling. And when they don't intervene, they don't care about these populations and they don't have principles. And so the U.S. has to make strategic choices that works for itself, not just for its principles. People are threatened by terrorism. People are threatened by state terrorism. People are threatened by autocracy, by corruption. But what the U.S. can do is do what it can, where it can, when it can, with the resources it's had, has, and then help build this global institutional order and deal with systems level change at the global order. And in the end, hopefully the U.S. is just more a force for good than for bad and for making things better and not worse. And if I could just conclude, the U.S. spends billions of dollars educating and empowering populations around the world. And perhaps that empowerment helps the next generation a lot, too. And that's a big part of this question as well.
That's William Lawrence, professor of international relations at the American University in Washington, speaking to VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi. That's all we prepare for you this Wednesday. We now leave you with Kennedy singing in his native Kakwa language. We've been listening to Kennedy singing in his Kakwa language. I don't understand what he's saying, but looks like it's a song about wife. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. Don't forget to visit voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this program, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. Thanks for taking time to be with us. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.